you have an intro. You're back.
I do.
You're
alive. I'm back.
You're
I'm
in
alive.
One piece. Yep. You are less psychologically than you were before. But
that's true.
You are still here. So how did your trip go?
Oh, Jim.
You're going to... David is like is hurting. I can see his pain.
You know, let me just ask this. Would you like some Buffalo Trace?
Sure.
I'll go get that.
Okay. Oh, this is wonderful. Thank you. David, this is my favorite whiskey.
I'm so glad.
Oh, I just love this. If this is a desert island whiskey for me, I don't know why this might have something to do with the fact that it's very affordable, but dang, this is.
Well, yes, there's that.
This stuff makes me happy.
Right.
So let's.
Now I can answer your question.
Let's intro our show and talk about your trip.
So, Jim, did you ever watch Crocodile Hunter?
Oh, I love that show.
Okay.
In fact, David, I have refrained from making Crocodile Hunter jokes in respect to our German speaking listener, Craig. I don't want to, you know, too soon. Like he'll be listening.
I mean, it's been like 15 years, but yeah, too soon.
Yeah. I mean, he'll be listening.
10 years anyway.
And he'll say, you know, too soon in an Australian way. Too soon.
I think you mean Austrian.
Sorry, Craig. I love you.
I used to love that show.
Used to? Come on.
Well, I don't watch it anymore.
It's on YouTube. Some of them.
That's interesting.
Me and I show the kids. We make a pizza and we watch Crocodile Hunter on YouTube as a family. So I can introduce them to the joys of the Crocodile Hunter. It's like passing down a legacy. It just makes me feel warm inside. A tear comes down my cheek.
Wow.
When I watch that show and talk to you. No, kidding. So Crocodile
Hunter. You've probably seen the episode. They talk about it in a few episodes about Crikey. How when you are trying to like move or capture a crocodile.
I've been there.
And they get like really agitated and excited afraid. They start pumping adrenaline.
The alligators do?
Crocodiles. Come on, son.
Sorry. That was dumb. Yes.
The crocodiles do.
Yes.
And they don't really regulate that well.
Gym like
their bodies do not regulate.
Alligator hunter. Okay.
Their bodies do not regulate adrenaline well. So they will just continuously pump it into their system until they die. And so they have to be very careful about how they move the crocodiles. Like often they'll just sedate them, I believe. But I remember, I think where I saw this was they had a pregnant crocodile.
So they don't stop.
That they couldn't sedate. Yeah, they don't. They'll just like, and they like, even if they can't move, like even if they're just stuck, they will, or they'll also, you know, you put them in the box and they'll hurt themselves.
Wow. This is really interesting information.
I was this crocodile.
Sir, in seat 3, calm down. We're going to have to sedate you.
Not the plane, just the whole trip. Well, yeah, the plane too.
Are you giving us
I
a
hope
glimpse?
My in-laws don't listen to this because
are you giving us a glimpse into like how you feel during travel?
This is how I feel about like vacation-y travel.
Oh, you
like,
poor guy.
And I'll be totally honest with you, Jim. I do not understand why people like tropical climates.
Well, like, I mean,
you warm, go there and you work as hard as you can to avoid what the climate actually is. Like you try to put up shade so that you can stay out of the sun.
Cool drinks, daiquiris.
You drink cold drinks because it's very hot. I mean, it was only like 80 degrees, but it was like 70% humidity.
You splash in the pool.
Nothing you own will get dry the entire time that you were there.
Okay, check.
Because it's so humid. And like, I grew up in this environment, like not a tropical environment, but in the summers it would be like 90 and humid.
So where you were, this is definitely tropical.
Yes.
Because my only experience of anything close to that was Hawaii, where it is very dry, actually.
Right.
And the beaches and the weather is just sublime in Hawaii.
I might give you that. Yeah. I might give you that.
So yeah, that would be awful. I would not be happy in an environment.
Really?
Like that.
That's interesting. No, everybody loved it. I mean, it wasn't altogether unpleasant as long as you weren't outside for too long.
And how did you spend your time there? Were you just relaxing in the shade, avoiding the penetrating heat of the sun?
I tried to be in the shade. That was, I would read or I would,
code.
Yes.
Code some Relight.
I really didn't get very far on coding
because you were drinking issues. You were drinking too much. Oh, Wi-Fi. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
It took me until the very last day to find a whiskey that I really liked there. And that was the early times that I slacked you about, but cause this was all inclusive, Jim. Everything
which is
included.
Why they served you early times in Johnny Walker Red.
Exactly.
Man,
exactly.
No, you poor guy. You couldn't smuggle anything in? No.
No, I think I could have. I just didn't want to.
Okay. Well, some of the free stuff's good.
No, so it occurred to me during this trip that most people, lots of people, have jobs that they don't like. They have something about their routine maybe that they don't like, whether it's their marriage or their job or both or their kids or what have you.
Like listening to our show.
They get up every day. They do the same thing. They, and they don't like some part of that or all of it.
So basically living through your 30s.
And vacation, something like that. Vacation.
Yeah.
Vacation is a break from that. It's a break from all of it. Like the whole point of vacation.
This is David, this is ideal. This is ideal here.
What do you mean?
You're describing what a vacation should be.
Well, and more that's why people like.
Well, the funny thing is some people complain about how exhausting vacations are.
Well, yeah.
Because so much work has to be put into it. And that's just why I kind of made that comment.
I gotcha.
Yeah.
I realized on this trip that I am the inverse of everybody.
Okay.
Where like, David, no matter how bad
David
my life
finally
is,
realized.
The routine is still a comfort.
Well, yeah. So,
like, yeah. No matter how bad my routine is, it will always be worse to break it in a dramatic way for a week. Like, I will always hate that more.
Folks, the David you're listening to is the true David. You are getting like real down to earth, David. We're going deep inside.
Yep.
We're going deep undercover, and this is totally how you feel.
This is how I feel.
Oh,
and
boy.
So the only things that brought me comfort during this trip were things that I normally do.
So what were those things?
Let's see. I just being with Sarah.
Okay, that's good. Like, check. That's fun.
The let's see, reading, like hanging out on Slack. I actually found that to be very. Very, what's the word? Comforting.
Hey guys, what are you doing?
Exactly. Well, you might have noticed I was just on there for I think most of Saturday. I was just like, hey, like here's pictures and like let's talk about stuff, guys.
No, you were posting pictures of your legs.
That's true. I did that.
And I
never thought I would do that.
Yeah, but me either. And I stared at your legs, your bare legs, for the longest time, thinking, well, this is the first and last time.
Yep.
I'll probably ever get to see David's bare legs, and I don't want to do it again. They were very berry.
Let's see. The Friday, Friday, Monday, and Tuesday, the stock market was open. So
so you were just
waltzing through Wall Street title.
Okay. Thank you, David.
Where were we? And working on Relight, really. Those were the things that brought me the most comfort.
Did you find rest that we all seek and few ever find?
I also, I mostly ate things that had to die for me to be able to eat them. Like whenever I needed a heuristic for finding food because it was always buffet style.
That's one way to describe the eating process.
And so I just tried to find as much meat as I could. That's just, I mean, it was all complimentary. That's what you do. You just eat all the meat.
Yeah. Eat all the meat. Eat all the fun stuff.
Right.
Well, I guess that's good.
Meat. What's fun?
Well, I mean, to people like me, which is, you know, everyone else. Eating is it's fun. It's an activity.
Right.
We like textures. We like chewing certain things versus others. We like swallowing certain things.
Versus
others.
So weird.
The act of eating can be fun and fulfilling.
Like playing with your food.
Yeah, playing with our food
when you're seven.
You know,
blowing bubbles in your milk.
You know, diverting from our depression into an escape through food, which is what I've been doing my whole adult life. So you know there is that, but I'm glad
if I may say you do seem very good at it.
Thank you. So David, I gotta give you props. The fat jokes are pretty good.
Thank you.
They're actually really good. I mean,
I try not to go for the obvious ones.
I don't want to be mad. I'm more impressed. So
I guess all I'm trying to say is it really seems like for me, like, my adult life has been me learning that I pretty much just don't like vacation. Like the whole concept of vacation is break away from the routine.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, well, but for me, what's relaxing is the routine.
You're okay with routine. Yeah.
I'm not just okay with it. It's where I derive comfort.
Yeah. There's a lot more people like you. So don't single yourself out, because I think a lot of us value routine. Hmm. You more than others. But this reminds me of the time where I finally realized that I hate golf.
Oh.
No, I mean, I played golf frequently in my youth, all the way up until my 30s. And from the beginning, I realized I truly, deeply, profoundly hate this game. I hate the game of golf. I hate playing it.
Hmm.
I hate the time that it takes.
Hmm.
I hate how hot it is, how much you have to walk, how expensive it is,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and how frustrating it is to play this stupid game. And I just finally realized that I hate playing golf. So whenever somebody asks me to play golf, I say no.
Oh, wow. That's good.
So this is a big step.
Right.
You're not really supposed to say no because it's a chance to get out and enjoy some beers while you golf.
Right.
And you get to drive a cart and you're just there for 6 hours and you spend $700 to enjoy some Bud Light and you've, you know, hitting a stick. No, hitting a ball with a stick very badly.
All for the sake of
all day.
All for the sake of 18 and a half grass holes.
Possibly another episode title. So yeah, David realizes that he loves routine and he's
did
okay
I say
with
a dozen
it.
And a half or 18 and a
you
half?
You said 18 and
I
a
meant
half.
A dozen and a half.
We'll fix it in next week's follow up.
All for the sake of a dozen and a half grass holes.
Great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for fixing that. So yeah, I hate golf and you love routine. And here we are today. It makes up you and me.
That's true.
Now then. Well, that was great. That was a good little recap of your vacation. I'm glad you're here. You don't get to fly in the flying death tube anymore.
I don't mind I don't like the disease factor of airplanes, but I don't mind like the flying part.
Oh.
Other than the like TSA. Being cramped.
Maybe the TSA.
I really dislike TSA.
TSA. Okay. And getting on the plane, you're stuck in the jetway.
And just the whole idea that like if I left something at home, like, well, I'm now hundreds of miles from where I started and cannot go get that thing.
Okay. Well, you did leave Jim at home. So all right. Well, good.
I should have derived comfort from that.
Jim is thousands of miles away. I now feel good about that. Well, good. I'm glad.
Hundreds. Okay. Let's start the show.
Let us start the show, David.
Is that what we do now?
That's what we do.
Okay.
All right.
The podcast you are about to hear contains the histrionic and problematic conversations of a stodgy Presbyterian and a casserole-loving Baptist. Their interactions are volatile at times and unpleasant most of the time. In many nations, this is considered a mild form of torture. We strongly advise you to stop this nonsense and go do something useful with your life. Otherwise, if you insist on listening to this mess, welcome to the lightest form of flogging.
As the deep voice man said, welcome to the lightest form of flogging. I am your co-host, David, sitting at the first table.
Okay.
And sitting across the room from me at a contractually negotiated 29 and a half feet at the second table is my co-host Jim Briggs, who once tweeted, "Sorry, losers and haters, but my IQ is one of the highest, and you all know it. Please don't feel so stupid or insecure. It's not your fault."
You know, most of them are pretty stupid, his tweets. But that one was a pretty pointed, like, you know exactly where Donald Trump is, where he stands on that tweet, and what he's trying to say. Mm-hmm. I appreciate his clarity.
Well, you usually see the punctuation. It's awful.
Okay, thank you. Because I was just going to say, usually you don't get much clarity from the man.
No, there's like commas with no spaces. It's rough.
Yeah, like, you know, I have a lot in common with Donald Trump, now that I think about it. We both write the same way. We think the same way. We run countries the same way. Mm-hmm. Our hair is the same way.
Both have small hands.
I actually kind of do. I truly do. I don't have very big hands. Anyways, hey, show, we're in it.
Is this a show?
This is a show. I am more than impressed with your host introduction. It more than makes up for the atrocity of my host introduction last week, which was so weak. I felt really bad.
Well, you were literally reading out of your common book.
I was trying to find ideas. So,
commonplace book.
Commonplace book. Next week, I will endeavor to live up to the standard that you have just set the host introduction.
Well, I appreciate that.
All right. Any announcements that we have to make? We did our...
No.
No? Really? So there's really no housekeeping to take care of. Might as well jump right in.
We have follow-up, which is kind of a form of housekeeping.
Okay.
The lightest form of housekeeping.
The lightest form of housekeeping. Well, you have most of the follow-up, so why don't you go ahead and do yours. I'll do mine last.
Okay. I screwed up last episode in tremendous ways.
How did you... What are you talking about?
So, I guess maybe you just weren't online, but last Saturday...
I'm trying to think.
Everybody...
what did we talk about last week again?
No. The uploading of it.
Oh. Right.
So I got the, at first it wouldn't let you download it because the access to the file was forbidden. Then I got access to the file working, but it was the wrong file. It was the file from the previous week. And then like an hour after that debacle, right. I got the right file uploaded, but it still has the wrong album artwork. If you download the episode to your podcast
player. What's going on with you?
Well, I was traveling.
Okay.
I was in Colorado trying to wrap this up while also playing with a 3D model of Baby Yoda that I had downloaded off the internet.
It kept you calm in the flight.
Well, I'd actually, that was another thing that, yeah, I played a little bit with Baby Yoda. Felt really good. Jim just needs to watch Mandalorian.
Okay. I promise. Everyone keeps calling him Baby Yoda. That's not actually Baby Yoda, right? Is it just a baby from the same species?
This is the thing, Jim.
How? Whoa. No, that can't be. He's 900 years old.
He is, of course. But like Star Wars is just crazy enough to where it could easily be a reincarnation.
No, Jim, don't do this.
I'm not saying that's what it is.
No.
What I'm saying is they haven't said that it is. They also haven't said that it isn't. He's just somebody who looks like a baby version of Yoda.
If that's all that we have. If that's it, okay.
I'm just saying.
We're not going to go down that road of lazy writing where we'd start to incorporate time travel.
No. I was thinking reincarnation.
Which is the sign that the writers have run out of creative ideas.
I was thinking reincarnation, Jim. Because that's an Eastern kind of idea.
You were trying to say it's a Middle Earthian kind of idea. Okay.
It's an Eastern kind of idea, and Star Wars mythology is heavily rooted in Eastern mysticism.
Okay.
So I'm not saying that it is. Okay. I'm just saying I haven't personally completely excluded it. And that's one of the things I love about the show is we're like five episodes in now, I think.
Okay.
And nobody knows who this guy is. Is he Yoda? Is he just from the, I think he's probably just from the same species. Well, who knows?
I'm certainly not opposed to having some fun Yoda stuff come back, but you can make a Star Wars movie with new characters and have it still be Star Wars. I wish people would understand this.
Well, that is essentially what this has been.
Now, that being said, I'm very excited to see Emperor Palpatine come back in Rise of Skywalker. I am totally down with that. Some people are freaking out about it. I want that guy back. It is so cool when he is on screen. Mm. He was the best part of Revenge of the Sith, in my opinion. He made that movie, in my opinion. But that being said, I hope they don't play around with this Yoda thing. Anyways, go right on ahead, David.
I'm just going to show you here real quick, because this is important, of course.
All right.
There he is.
It looks so...
I rendered
it. It looks like a gremlin from... It's like Mogwai from Gremlin. The Gremlin movie. Mm. Have you ever seen Gremlins?
I have not. He's much cuter in the...
I'm saying it looks like a toy. It literally looks like a toy.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you need to watch Mandalorian and then we'll talk. Then we'll talk to you.
All right. I'll calm down.
Anyway, so just in case the reason this is in follow-up is just in case you downloaded last week's episode and it was the same as the week before.
Right.
If you delete it and re-download it, you will get last week's episode. So wait, hold on.
Are there people that could download this show right now and it will be last week's show?
This week, this show?
No. At the time of recording, the episode before this one.
No. The correct file is up, so anybody downloading it... So what happened was, for an hour, if they downloaded it during that hour, their catcher would have had the wrong episode. And if they are just listening to it now for whatever reason, they may discover that...
I'm just really sensitive over here
about
losing listeners because of issues. And I will ask you in another couple weeks the question that you hate me asking. Which is what are our download numbers? And you'll say, I don't know, Jim.
Four.
Is that it? Is that enough for you, Jim? And then it'll be my turn to quit the show. Go ahead.
Let's see. The next one here is yours. Do you want to do it?
Yeah. We were talking, we had a small discussion about the Enlightenment influence on our founding fathers. Our founding fathers were heavily influenced by the Reformation. John Calvin, Martin Luther. No. Heavily influenced.
I've heard people make this argument that like John Calvin is the reason our Constitution is the way it is.
Okay. heavily influenced by the Enlightenment. And I said, just in passing, I said, Charles Hume, I actually meant to say David Hume,
right?
Not Charles Hume. Mm-hmm. So, you know, hey, I think the best way to capitalize on Jim's mistakes is to make a skit out of it. So who knows? I might invent an Enlightenment thinker named Charles Hume, and a much frivolity may ensue. Who knows? He might meet Hellcat Maggie.
Well, thank you for enlightening us on that point, Jim. Next up, I meant to say Carson, but I said Keller. And last week I did the same thing again. what I did was
this was
episode Ben, 66.
This was Ben calling you out on this one.
Yeah, episode 66 at 15:10. I said that Keller looks in Carson's commentary on John. Sorry. I said
okay.
that Carson that Tim Keller, I guess, looks in this commentary to see what Tim Keller has said about John in that passage. I meant to say what Carson has said about John in that passage. But okay. Right. I got it wrong, and then Ben corrected me, and that following week I got the correction wrong.
Wait a minute. This is not a poor reflection on you, David. This is a poor reflection on me. Because when that error first went by, I said, okay, that's good. When you did it, when you fixed it in follow-up, I said, oh, thanks for doing that. That makes sense.
And poor Ben's just like throwing his hands up in the air.
I feel so stupid. Okay, well, I'm glad we got that one figured out.
Next up is, I just wanted to say that our first, Sarah and I watched Spirit and Truth over the weekend.
Hey!
That was very comforting, too. Hell, really, really good.
Okay, now, when we're going to talk about Spirit and Truth in a future episode, hopefully soon, when I get to see it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But when you say it's good, are you saying it's good because of filmmaking prowess, movie making skill, or because this is just your thing, and this is your chance to get on the stage of life and get the regular principle going, rocking and rolling, freestyling, limousine riding, kiss stealing. I'm doing a Ric Flair thing. Never mind. I'll address it next week.
They just have this expression of horror. Like, when is he going to stop?
I'm trying to do the Ric Flair thing. Is it that though? It could be the worst movie in the world, but
you're just
excited because it's the regular principle. It's less than fear, capitalizing on his success,
right?
And talking about new Calvinists, and now
you know how much I love it when people make fun of and or correct new Calvinists. You know that,
yes.
But the artwork in this movie, the cinematography, the music, everything down to all the little details, are just. I mean, it may be the best Christian documentary that I've ever seen. It's better than Calvinist in that regard.
That's high praise.
But then at the same time, the message that he communicates, obviously you're right. Like, I'm on board with the message, although he's not exclusive psalmody. He's not against instruments in worship that I know of.
Okay.
I mean, he doesn't communicate those as like the application of the message.
So yeah.
But there is a nice rant from pastor of a college church, Kevin DeYoung, about how probably
so is the celebrity drastically reduced in this one? I saw the trailer and I didn't see a whole lot of names that I remember. Puritan Theological Seminary preacher guy, really good preacher. His last name's really hard to pronounce. Come on,
Beaky.
Yes.
Wait, what?
He's the only guy I recognize.
Really hard to pronounce.
Well, what are you gonna say, Beak?
Oh, you mean when you read it, not
once
you've heard it.
No, once.
I said it as a joke because I thought, it's just like two syllables with like two consonants.
Well, Beaky or Beak. I don't know what it is. I don't want to say Beak.
It's Beaky, I believe.
Because he's less of a preacher when I say Beak.
Right.
When it's Joel BK, and it sounds much better. Anyways, drastically reduced celebrity.
You got Bob Coughlin.
He's in there. What does he have to say?
I thought it was the weirdest thing that he was in there. I'm so glad that you're looking at me with furrowed brow and concerned eyes.
I mean, I know the guy knows his stuff, but what is he doing in that documentary?
You will see.
Okay.
Little fool.
Little
fool. Stupid fat hobbits.
Whoa. Hey, come on now.
I'm sorry. I wasn't talking about you.
Hey, shut up. I'll get back to my little Debbie here. Stop making fun of me. I'm sorry.
At first, that sounded very Jim Gaffigan. Anyway, in that movie, Les leads off things by talking about first and second table differences and how the first table is actually more important than the second.
Oh, hey, our show is relevant.
Our show is relevant. Did I put that there? I guess not. No. But yes, our show is relevant. That's official now. And then I ordered Derek's book today, so that'll be here in time for us to sign at our next episode and follow up.
Yes.
And then ship at our next episode in follow-up.
Okay, great.
And it should be to him by 5 episodes from then in follow-up.
2025. Okay, Derek. Look forward to that book in the mail. sometime in the near future.
And now, Jim, I believe it is time for one of your favorite things in the whole show.
Which is to stop the show, do a musical break, and then resume the main topic.
Exactly, because all the right. show's not happening during the musical break.
Indeed, we're paused. We're suspended in animation. I don't know.
We are suspended in animation.
Yes, title. Our show becomes... Thank you. Our show has become animated. No, we're going to take a quick break. Then we'll be on the other side of the break. On the flip side of the break, we'll be back with our main topic. Folks, just wait on a second. Here we go. Music break. And now. We're back, folks. Today is an interesting topic, a topic that I think we should have talked about, like, oh, I was about to say years ago. Can we say that yet? We started Maybe. In 2018. So I wanted to start a long time ago, but we just have avoided it. But we're going to talk about Bible translations today.
Yeah, something got lost in translation.
Okay. David has been waiting to do that joke, and now that it's here, I feel empty inside. So we're going to talk about Bible translations today. Not the kind of show that you might be accustomed to hearing. We're not just going to go through and tell you what the best one is and what the translation differences are.
I mean, it's obviously the
philosophy
message.
What?
The message is obviously the best one.
Okay. Yes. That's what I was about to say. Mm-hmm. I have it in my hand here. But we're going to talk about kind of our history with Bible translations, how we started off, perhaps how we went wrong, if we want to use that word, and where we are today.
Right.
And then I'm sure we will find ways to argue about something later. So let me go ahead and start. So here we go. So when I first started reading a Bible, when I converted, actually, no, I'm going to go back even farther. My very first Bible in Lutheran church was called
German.
The good Word Bible. And it was like the American Contemporary translation, a real obscure translation that since then I have not heard of. And I know I'm getting it wrong. This is just prime for next week's follow-up.
But hooray!
I'm going to have to actually go through and I still have it actually, but it was a real, a hugely thick Bible. I got it in like third grade. It was called the Good Word Bible or something like that. It had really strange drawings in it. And it was like the American Contemporary translation, American Evangelical translation, something like that. I can't quite remember. But I just kind of held on to that and didn't really read it. But when I became a Christian, my first Bible was NIV. Mm. And at the time, I think this was peak NIV. I think a lot of people were using it. At least that was my impression.
Okay, okay.
This is early 2001.
Space Odyssey.
And a ton. I think that's like, if you were an evangelical non-denominational church, you were issued NIV Bibles. I mean, that's just, the preachers preached from it. All the preachers that I encountered.
It was kind of a drought. I mean, the NASB had been out for a while. And if you didn't like the NASB, basically the NIV was your go-to. I remember John Piper was weird because he preached out of the RSV.
He did?
Yeah, until the ESV came out, which was, I think, 2001.
That's legit.
Was when the ESV
if you do RSV before ESV, that's like almost street cred level. If you're willing to
obscure.
Use. Yeah, I think John Stott used RSV.
Yeah. So if some well, of the RSV was very popular in the academy.
Maybe that's what it was. Okay, yeah. That makes sense. Most preachers preached out of the NIV because I think it was the most accessible. It was probably the most approachable. It was very easy to read. And it was one of those, it's kind of like how ESV operates in the Calvinist community right now. If you're a Calvinist, you're kind of sent one in the mail and you're kind of told this is your translation.
I get three a week.
I just got to change my address.
That's called moving.
Okay. But no, I mean, I'm kind of making a joke here, but I mean, if you're, when you get your membership card in the mail, when you join the new Calvinist club, I mean, it's strongly suggested that you utilize an ESV Bible.
There are people who are not Calvinists who joke about how the fact that the Calvinists are all Calvinists because they read the ESV.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, these are fun people. So kind of like that, I think a lot, for the same reasons, a lot of people use the NIV. So that was the Bible I had. I think at the time, New King James was popular too. I see a lot.
Yeah.
I had a lot of people I knew that grew up on the KJV and went to the New King James Version.
Right.
Since then, I don't know anybody that today uses the New King James Version. And I don't know why.
Question for you.
Because, yes?
Who publishes the NIV?
Zondervan.
Okay. That's in the United States. Everywhere else, it's Biblica. Who publishes the NKJV?
NKJV? Tyndale, right?
No.
Okay.
No. Okay.
That's my only guess.
This is a quiz not to show your ignorance, but to show everybody's ignorance that nobody knows or cares about Bible publishers.
No one does.
The only one that has any brand recognition is Crossway.
I know that.
I don't know why they have that recognition, but they do.
But
I just find it mildly interesting.
But why though? I mean, why? That just seems like a strange thing to zero in on. I mean, I'm vague. I know
because ESV. I worked in Christian publishing and brands in Christian publishing care a lot about their brand. Like Thomas Nelson wants to be known as the company that produces the NKJV, but nobody makes that connection.
NIV was the thing, and I never really understood the hubbub about it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I didn't really participate in any translation wars at the time.
Right.
Because the KJV, I was aware of it. I had a KJV Bible on a bookshelf in my house. Mm-hmm. Don't know how it got there, but it was there. And I was aware that it was a translation, and I was aware that it was old. And I knew that it was the most Jesus-ish translation because a lot of people said, or if they quoted the Bible, they quoted the King James Version. Mm. And it's been around forever. And so I started to get a little crazy in my faith. I started to become kind of like one of those on fire, crazy Pentecostal Christians. The main influencer in my life, my best friend at the time, was a rabid, crazed KJV user. Mm. I'm talking Gail Ripplinger level.
Did he foam at the mouth?
Yeah.
Okay.
If he saw my NIV,
right.
He had comments about it and convinced me within days that the NIV was of the devil and I was supposed to be using KJV, and I went and bought one and I used KJV exclusively. I was a KJV onlyist, full on. Oh, for about 4 or 5 years.
Can I ask you a couple questions about this? Because I'm really curious.
So I actually had Gail Ripplinger's book, the famous one that she wrote against the modern translations. Hmm. And I took it in and embraced it and thought it as gospel. Hmm. I was rabid. I would people in my small Christian circle that used NIV, I would pull out the Gail Ripplinger book. I almost carried it with me like I was a missionary for freaking... And I would go through and I would find some passages where Lucifer refers to Lucifer as the morning star. Morning star, a phrase used in Revelation for Jesus. And I said, aha, do you see this? No, I don't know. I don't know why I'm talking like that. I all of a sudden become Yiddish. Aha, do you see this?
L'chaim.
L'chaim, spatula, a word that's not Yiddish, but should be.
That's fair. This is life-changing.
That's fair. Think about it. It's not Yiddish, but it should be.
Hey, the spatula.
Spatula, son. Anyways, I would point out connections like that. And I would get, I still remember to this day, one of my better friends, the look he gave me, it truly was like I had an arm growing out of my forehead.
Right.
And
that would be so useful.
No. A tail would be useful.
A tail growing out of your forehead?
No. No.
That's definitionally not a tail.
Jim? No. So I went through that phase, and I just wanted to mention that I was just a Gail Ripplinger disciple.
Okay.
And I was just full-on crazy. And also another big influencer of my KJV onlyism was Kent Hovind, of all people.
Oh, Kent.
And you're familiar with him, right?
Of course I'm familiar with him.
Yeah, I loved his creation stuff. Someday we'll talk about creationism. Mm-hmm. And old earth stuff. And
I'm a big fan of creation.
Good. Me too.
I just don't like to be out in it.
Okay. David McCookie for the win, as per usual. And he pointed me to that Gail Ripplinger stuff, and mm-hmm, I just mm-hmm. ate it all up. So that was me at the time, shortly after my conversion.
So a couple questions, because, spoilers, but I'm a KJV guy now, not rabid.
But you are not a KJV onlyist.
No.
Right. Good.
I mean, not in any meaningful sense,
but close.
The questions I want to ask are, so you came into this KJV thing relatively early in your Christian walk.
Yep.
Would you say prior to that point, you had a lot of experience with older forms of English? Were you big into Shakespeare or?
No, I wasn't.
Classic literature?
Nope.
Okay. How difficult then did you find reading the KJV, and were there resources to help you understand that, like, for example, let doesn't mean let in the KJV.
Not familiar with that, but I will say, yes, it was, especially Paul. I don't know what it is about KJV in the Pauline epistles, but Romans was almost unintelligible for me.
Hmm. Okay.
It very much was. Now, that might have been because I just wasn't familiar with the language and how to read the syntax and how the sentence flows, because things are kind of mixed around a little bit sometimes in the KJV. And there were some archaic right. Well, words.
That's because of following the Greek more strictly. I grew up in a church with the I grew up in a church with a NASB, and everyone felt similarly about Romans because the sentence structure is
in
a thwack relative to normal English.
With NASB, really?
Yeah, yeah.
I never found it that. I thought when
now the NASB, as you would say,
the NASB. When I finally embraced that translation, everything was made right again because I could finally understand Romans. I think this is a perspective issue.
It probably is. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that Romans is just a difficult book if you're new to the Christian faith anyway. So I wonder.
Well, it's a difficult book in the ESV.
Right. Right.
No matter what easy translation.
It's really easy in the Message, but it's actually just about how to bake a raspberry pie.
Okay. Sounds about right. I found it very, very difficult, but I thought this is God's word. It doesn't matter if I struggle through it. This is the translation I got and nothing else. If I read anything else, I'm drifting towards Lutheranism. No, I mean...
because of the mystery.
Luciferianism. What? I don't mean to... I'm going to leave that in.
I hope you do.
But just... that's not what I meant. So it didn't matter if I didn't understand it. I would endeavor to do it. So like that friend that I told you about that influenced me in the KJV, he found this cool list of archaic words in their modern definitions. I actually still have it, as a matter of fact. It was like it wasn't like a dictionary or anything, but it was like a one-page bookmark. Yep. That had a bunch of... so I could look up archaic words. Like, I didn't know what lest meant for the longest time.
Mm-hmm. ESV, that's the past tense of Les Lamphere.
Right, right. It's still used in ESV.
Right. So, for example, if I were to give you a copy of Spirit and Truth, I would have lessed you.
Thank you for lessing me this copy of Spirit and Truth.
No, see, that's lessing.
Okay. the lessening of Les Lamphere. Another episode title. This is what we constantly do to the man. Oh, boy. It's going to be fun when we get him on the show.
Deep into KJV, onlyanism, as you would say.
Yeah.
How did you then... Wait, why did you want to talk about this?
Because it was one of the last frontiers of our past. That's theology-ish that we could talk about. And I figured we might as well do it.
The final frontier.
Yeah, because it's, we've never mentioned anything on Bible translations. And this is all how we have grown through time and how we approach
and space
in the final frontier. And these are the voyages of Jim and David.
A continuing mission to explore strange new concepts.
So there you go.
So how did you migrate out of this?
How did I migrate out of this? So what happened was, this is kind of a funny story, but very painful. And I held on to my KJV onlyism into college. And I had with me, I still have the Bible. It's a Cambridge version, the first publisher of the KJV. They still make some cool KJV Bibles still to this
day. Those are high quality Bibles. They're
really, that's why I bought it. It's French Moroccan leather. It's Indian paper. The two columns.
Indian or Native American?
Two columns. Cherokee Nation paper. I really don't like the text format, the fonts. It's called like a pronunciation version.
Oh,
where all the difficult names are hyphenated out
in which syntax makes it, that you don't understand.
It makes it so much worse. So it's a hard to read.
Know how to read that pronunciation syntax, it's really great. But I don't. So
that's my only knock against it. But I had my name. What's the word? Gold gilded. You mean people have their names on their Bibles?
Imprinted?
I had my name imprinted on there, and I felt so proud. And that was the Bible I carried with me, my journey to the Southern Baptist Evangelical University with a theology degree. Almost my very first class. It was my first class was with Dr. Dubas, and the class was Fundamentals of Bible Hermeneutics or something. Introduction to Understanding the Bible. It was a hermeneutics class. And the very first question he asked, is there anybody in here that uses a KJV Bible? and Jim Briggs' hand goes straight up.
Right.
As not knowing that I was...
You were being set up.
Admiral Akbar was in the back going, "It's a trap!" And I didn't listen. I didn't listen. Right. I should have.
Well, he's a softly spoken gentleman.
Yeah, he's sitting on his elevated chair back there.
Right.
Saying, "It's a trap, Jim!" And I kept raising my hand, not really knowing that I was what I was in for. And he lit into, not me, but how horrible and awful the KJV Bible is for studying and scholarly pursuits. And it's an invalid translation for the modern world. And I was so embarrassed because I think I was the only person that raised my hand. I'm not quite sure. I felt it was like really harsh and unfair.
I'm sorry, Jim. I wish I could have been there.
I wish you were. Now, David, time right. travel back in the Wayback Machine.
Oh, yeah. If I had been there back then, I would have just pointed at you and laughed. I would have been like five.
To divert from your, to divert from your pain. No. And I never used it. I was so scarred from it. I never used my KJV regularly again.
Right.
After that, because it happened a couple
only
more times.
Only when you were irregular.
My philosophy professor did something similar to it, to that. I think it's because they just were so jaded by the country people, the Hill Southern Baptists.
Right.
Who were KJV only, who were, you know, if it's good enough for Paul, it's good enough for me.
Right.
They would bring in and just be obnoxious. Mm-hmm. So I don't entirely blame them for calling out the KJV and trying to root it out. But, I mean, I fell along with it and got rid of it. And I think I went straight to my beloved NASB. They have a Lifeway. I have a Lifeway bookstore right on campus. And I went and bought like a $100 super awesome NASB.
And you
Bible.
Were in college.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I mean, there is a problem, David, with Reformed people and their book buying habits.
Right.
We do silly, strange, unheard of, unspeakable things with our budgets when it comes to books. I may have gone through that and it may have lasted about a decade.
I don't think I've ever actually done this, but to be fair, yeah, I worked at a company for a while where I had free access to all the books.
So I got out of KJV onlyism. Straight into NASB, and I never looked back.
NASB onlyism?
Yep. It wasn't only, but I loved that Bible. Still have it.
I want to put a pin in something.
Can I also say one more thing?
You can.
I took my Gil Ripplinger book and a couple of other KJV-only literature that I had. I can't remember who wrote them. There might have been another Ripplinger book and a couple other books, but I literally had a gun. I shot the books and then burned them.
Wow.
It was cathartic for me.
Okay.
I looked, David is like, wow, this.
So Mr. This, Hitler.
I know I did. I shot them and burned them. Mm-hmm, I was so, mm-hmm. I wanted to just shed that part of my life away. Mm-hmm. And I know that's a little weird, but I felt like just saying it. Probably I should add more context to that, but I'm not, just to make the show more interesting.
I don't think it's weird to burn books.
It was as a cathartic.
I think that's fine.
I think it's weird to shoot them first. I know this. This is
you
getting,
know they're not alive.
This is going in bad directions. I was making a statement.
Right.
It was just me and my wife. There was just a bunch of things in my life that I wanted to get rid of that I thought were holding me back. So I just, and I liked guns at the time.
Right.
And so I just shot them almost to see what would happen.
Right.
But I'm going to stop trying to explain myself. Yes. I'm going to drink here. So yeah, there you go.
No, I want to put a pin in this discussion for a future episode, maybe even next week, which is the topic of, I remember back when I was doing youth ministry, yeah. I would radically oversimplify topics and I would say things that were only kind of true or that I could only sort of half prove or couldn't prove at all, but the assertion was strong and I knew it would be convincing.
Oh, okay.
And I suspect I you talking about your professors making these like grandiose statements about the KJV and how like scholars debate these things, but you're just making this assertion. You're just like, and I remember me being in Bible college, being in dispensational Bible college and having people say things.
Were they hostile against KJV?
They weren't hostile against the KJV, but having people say things about covenant theology that were just patently untrue.
Okay. Okay.
And you know, me now looks back at that and wonders like, did they know that what they were saying was just untrue? Like covenant theology necessarily leads to anti-Semitism. Like these are the kinds of statements that in a 101 class or in a youth message, you would say that are not actually true. There's a lot of nuance here. There's a lot of like things. Yeah. I mean, the covenant theology leading to,
you're talking about replacement theology, right?
Right. Right. Okay, that's just wildly untrue. And I've asked dispensationalists to show me somebody who actually is a replacement theologian and quotes, and they've never been able to do it.
Yeah.
But the point of what I'm getting at here is there is a kind of, you might call this rhetoric in teaching, where you're trying to convince people of the thing, and you believe that the thing is true and you believe that it's important. And so rather than get into the nuances and explain everything, you just make these audacious, yeah, like bombastic claims,
yes, yes,
that get guys like you to just go, yeah, I will, yeah, never read the KJV again.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I know what you're getting at. This might be interesting to talk about. I think this is really easy to do in bubbles.
Yes. Yes.
I've done this where I've said things that I knew at the time were not true, but I might've been trying to make a joke, make a zinger,
Right.
Make
right.
a zinger kind of punchline. And I willingly stretch the truth to say something bombastic for effect, but I willingly said it.
And it's in the circle of the wagon kind of crowd. Yes,
and it's with other people that I know for sure agree with me.
Right. It's always weird when you do that and there's somebody in the group who's like,
well, actually, that's been scientifically disproven.
Well, I appreciate those guys. I do too, but
you're always really awkward.
But when people think they're in a bubble, like in the pub, for example, when it happened in the pub, and then Paul Barth would come in from the mist and say, well, actually,
Paul wrote Hebrews,
and he would just slay them,
right,
in the spirit. Mm-hmm. Anyways. Yeah. That might be a good topic to.
Yeah.
Talk
I think
about.
That could be because I remember doing that. And now when I see it, I get kind of nauseous.
We've all done this.
Because almost all of the changes that I made in my theology have been from positions that were explained to me in that way. Not almost all, but a lot of them. So anyway, NASBY,
did you? I loved my NASB time frame.
Did you switch to the ESV when you came out to this church?
Yep.
Was that a smooth transition? Was that
smooth transition? I might be wrong, but I think the ESV is from the same, not the same publisher, but the same tradition, translation tradition. Am I correct? Obviously, they use the same manuscripts, but it. Let me say it this way. NASB, I think, for a time, was the ESV of its time. For Reformed people, for Calvinists, for scholarly-minded people, people in academia, because it was considered the most literal translation.
Right.
And I bought into this because my personal Bible would italicize words that were not in the original manuscripts, but the translators added because you have to. Mm-hmm. When you translate from Greek to English, you have to. I mean, it's natural for translation. It's essential to translate. You have to add in words to get the original context.
Right. Like a good example of this is in, I think this might be true in Greek, but I know it's true in Spanish. In Spanish, if you conjugate your verb, you don't need to have a pronoun. So if I conjugate the word tango, tener, and tener is to have. Yep. Tango is I have.
And then
I could say yo tango, which would be I have.
But you don't have to.
And that's
right?
not considered improper. Like you can say yo tango, which is yo is I and tango is I have.
Yeah.
But if you were to try to translate that into the KJV or the NASB, you would have to put the word would be tango. Because there would be no yo.
Yeah.
And you would put I in italics because there's no yo.
That's what I'm talking about.
Right.
I actually liked that because maybe this was not.
I also want to point out, it does not take two to tango. It takes one to tango. It takes two to tenamos.
Hey! Good work. So I really liked that feature of my NASB Bible. Mm-hmm. This italicized phrase, it's not in the original manuscripts. Not that I should forsake it because of that, but I liked to have that in mind.
It kind of gives you a feel.
Yes, I like to have
of
it,
the
it,
shape of how the thought was communicated, maybe.
Yeah, and that
at least makes you think you have that feel, because I often wonder how helpful that actually is.
Yeah, I mean, the ESV doesn't do that.
No, they don't.
There might be some.
That's a decision. The argument goes, and I've had this debate with people. Yeah. The argument goes the words are there. They're just not literally there. If you were to render this without these words, it wouldn't make sense. So the words are essentially there. They're communicated in the original words. It's just that the physical space, letter, 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 space doesn't occur in the original.
Yeah. Translation is not transliteration.
Exactly.
So I liked that feature. I liked just, you know, smaller things. The paper was really, really good.
On the ESE?
I love no, my NASB.
Well, yeah, you spent like $100 on it. Paper, and that's back when $100 was quite a bit of money.
Well, the ESV, I also bought at the time for fun an ESV thin line.
Okay.
It just started coming out. I bought the real nice one. Genuine leather thin line. And the paper was just, I mean, if I like looked at it crossly, it would like rip.
Yeah.
And I did not like thin paper, and my NASB was nice and thick, and I could write on it and it wouldn't bleed
thick
through.
With two C's. Mm-hmm.
It was fantastic. It was single column. I love single column. Mm-hmm. And it was verse, then, how do I explain this?
Paragraph.
It was one verse at a time. It was one verse at a time. It wasn't in paragraph form.
Right.
I also liked that. Good references, no commentary, enough room in the margins for me to make notes. This was my dream Bible. Mm-hmm. I still have it, and I want to. It's the binding is totally wrecked on it.
I know a guy who does rebinding. If you're interested,
I actually am. Seriously, I want to get this Bible back into my life. Mm-hmm. But I had that ESV thin line, and went to that when I moved to my new church, the church that you and I currently go to. Mm-hmm. And I thought I don't want to be reading. And like when the preacher would read the text for the day, I just got tired of reading my NASB. And you know, going to Bible studies with my NESB, and everyone else had ESV. I just kind of gave in and started.
Not only ESV, but like everybody specifically has the hardback ESV study Bible.
Yeah.
When I first came here, I was just like, is this what everybody has?
Well, it's in our bookstore and a lot of people have it. I do not like one volume commentaries. I despise them. I do not like one volume commentaries. So I never really.
Yeah. I mean, you have to have some dynamics, you know, loud, quiet. Medium pianoforte of Bible commentaries title.
This is a title rich episode.
I think so, it's forte. I think I just now mixed Italian and
I've given you my entire Spanish. History. So what about you?
All right. So I was born into the NASB.
You were born a poor black child.
As you would say, I was born a heathen and then accepted the ESV, the NASB into my heart
into
a few
heart.
Years later.
Thank you. Good.
When I made a profession of faith in the NASB.
the weird times, that Bible translation. They require such devotion.
I'm pretty sure. I mean, I don't remember like being 2 years old, but I'm pretty sure my church always used. Wait, when did the NASB come out?
1995. No, that was when.
That's the revision.
That
right?
was the revision that we used.
Was the NASB 1989? 88?
One of our listeners.
87. I'm pretty sure it's 87.
They're going to let us know in Slack.
Yeah, somebody will put it in follow up. But this is why we should do the show live. We'd have like five people here, like giving us little facts and Googling things for us. I listen to a show that does that. It's really handy.
I'm surprised that I don't know if this is a dispensational thing. Correct me if I'm wrong. Even the dispensational churches I went to used NIV. But an evangelical, you know, fairly straightforward, approachable church using NESB as their main preaching
Bible.
You
know, that's the thing about my church is, we haven't really talked about this, but like when I was born, they had a morning and an evening service.
Ah.
They sang all hymns, and then they had this like little tan booklet of like praise songs that they would sometimes sing out of. They didn't have a projector. They got an overhead projector, I think, when I was very young, but they didn't use it most of the time.
Okay.
Maybe like one song of service, they would use that.
Are you talking about the box where it's lit and there's okay.
Yeah.
I'm old enough to say I use that as well.
And the person has to like slide it around.
Yeah. We had someone up in front.
Honestly seems simpler than the computer solution.
I don't think
it's actually worse.
Less room for error, actually.
Exactly. I mean,
you have a human directly controlling. You don't have to worry about random clicks or phantom clicks.
Exactly.
Or
crashes.
Or crashes. That's right.
Or Windows.
The good old days.
Anyway, so it went from conservative to, I mean, they're still to this day kind of conservative, but the idea of like having a praise band and being more approachable and all of that kind of happened over maybe the 20 or so years that I was alive in that church.
Okay.
But anyway, so I grew up on the NASB, but I did do Awana.
Interesting.
And Awana used the NKJV.
Oh.
So I have a decent amount of memorization in the NKJV, although most of it's probably lost to other translations by now.
Well, you'll be pleased to know the very few Bible verses I have memorized in the KJV.
In the KJV?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Anyway. Verily. So yeah, I used the NISB for a long time. I think it was in maybe junior high, like middle school, maybe first year of high school. Mm-hmm. I started getting into digital Bibles and digital Bible software. And that is when I discovered that Bibles are published by companies.
Okay.
And then those companies want money in exchange for their Bible.
The dark secret.
So Bibles. The software that I was using, the ESV was free and everything. And so was the KJV.
Yeah.
I think that was the case. That's the case in most software. Like UVersion is like the one exception where you can get the NASB for free, but you can't download it for free. You can stream it for free, if you will.
Holdman. That's the publisher.
Lockman.
Sorry. I'm going to stop talking.
It's okay. You should expect for me to know a lot more about Bible publishers than you.
I don't feel bad about being corrected. But.
I feel bad about knowing this stuff.
Okay.
Holdman.
That's Holman.
And you're thinking of the HCSB or the CSB.
I used that for like 5 minutes.
So NASB for a while. And then I got frustrated because I didn't have $20. You know, I was like 15. Like, I don't want to spend $20 on a Bible translation.
Yeah.
So that's when I switched to the KJV for a while. Started using the YLT.
For fun, right?
Well, it was because it was free and I could read the Bible digitally.
You were a digital guy.
Right.
Okay.
And I mean, I had a print NASB still. But I started to really like dislike the NASB because like the Bible should be free. Like, I totally understand if you're going to buy a print Bible, it costs money to print that. But like, this download should not cost money. This is 4 megabytes.
I'm so glad I lived in mostly ignorance of the Bible publishing industry, because that would that would kind of, you know, that'd be, make me a little jaded.
And that's when it started dawn on me with the NASB. I was like, why does this cost money?
And I hear that they're pretty strict about their copyright.
Lockman is very strict about their copyright.
Yeah, that is a bit of a turnoff, isn't it?
And even down to like how much of it you can print in like, you know, teaching materials or whatever. Yeah. Like Lockman is like, I think it's like, I don't want to like pull a 9CV here, but I think it's like a quarter of what other publishers like the ESV. Huh. I will look that up and address it and follow up. But I remember noticing that it was significantly less. And what I wanted to do when I was teaching was print off these like sheets that people could mark up and everything.
Yeah.
And you just can't do that with the NASB. You actually can't do it with the ESV unless you get permission. Like if you wanted to print off a couple chapters of this thing and just hand it out to your class, you can't. Like you can use that many verses as long as that many verses doesn't construct more than 30%, I think it is, of the overall thing. And
hold on, they say this, but how much of this has been enforced?
Well, it's not like they're gonna barge in. You know, I start teaching Sunday school
right now. Stop right, put that down.
What the heck?
Put that paper down now, right, sir. Okay. All right, well, that I wanted to say that because, you know, that might be in the literature. I don't know if there's lawyers involved.
They do enforce it on the internet. I mean, I had to go to them. I don't know how much of this I want to put on because I think it's largely behind the scenes, like private negotiations with Crossway. But I am working toward getting the ESV for Relight. And it's not a simple matter with their light. This is public knowledge. It's not a simple matter of, I can find the ESV out there on the ethers, and I could just throw it onto my site, you know, format it and put it on there.
You can't do that.
But if I did that, I would, and I know I have a friend who got a cease and desist order.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad I'm not the only one who sells my soul.
So anyway, I decided that the ESV, since it was available for free on most of the Bible software that I wanted to use, that was going to be my translation. It seemed really faithful. It seemed really decent.
Yeah.
John Piper was using it. This was around the time that I was getting into John Piper, although he was late on that train. He used the RSV for a while. By the way, to answer your question,
what?
The ESV comes out of the translation history of the RSV. NASB comes out of the translation history of the ASV.
Okay, I knew this.
And the ESV, honestly, is like a, as you would say, half donkey.
What do you mean?
Update to the RSV.
Okay.
Half grass hole.
I'm still not getting it. What are you trying to say?
It's a lazy, lazy update to the RSV.
Okay.
It is largely the RSV. There are a few places.
I haven't done a comparison.
Where like in Isaiah, it says a woman will bear a child instead of a virgin, will conceive and bear a child.
Yeah.
The ESV changes that from woman back to virgin, even though in the Hebrew it actually is woman.
Okay.
In the Greek, it's virgin.
In Isaiah?
No, the quotations of it from the Greek. It's virgin, but in the Hebrew, it's actually woman. So,
they
walked back some of what were considered liberal decisions, and then they made a couple other changes here and there. They added Wayne Grudem's argument for prophecy. Like it's literally like he's the only one who translates it that way, and the ESV, and he was on the committee. So, like the changes to the ESV are like to support the charismatic movement, to avoid liberalism. I'm completely serious. Okay. And to support the complementarian movement.
I mean, I'm gonna take what you say. I'm gonna take it, and I'm gonna hold it. I'm gonna put it in my pocket.
Ponder these things in your heart.
I'm gonna ponder these things in my heart. But I would like to confirm that.
Yeah, Wayne Grudem thing. Like, that's absolutely the case.
I have never heard of that.
He talks about it in his systematic theology about how he translates it that way.
I'm vaguely,
his systematic theology was written a long enough time ago to where he has to make that a big deal because
is
the
he
ESV,
an editor or is he a direct translator of one of the books?
He was an.
I seem to remember.
There are no real translators. Like
there are. One of my professors from Union translated the pastorals.
I challenge you to read the pastorals in the RSV and in the ESV. Translator literally just mean people who make decisions about whether RSV.
I'm not pressing you on the differences between RSV and ESV or the lack thereof.
Grudem was
focusing on the prophecy. And I
think he was a theological editor.
I know there are committees. Okay, all right. But I know that there are translation committees. These guys have to argue with each other,
right,
in order to get things to go through. And
no, I'm not saying it was Wayne Grudem single-handedly, but he is the only person who wants to translate it that way.
Okay, all right.
And that's the ESV is the only translation, and he was on the committee. So like, those are the facts that I can present without. And I didn't actually draw any conclusions from that.
Okay,
There are changes in the ESV that support charismaticism. There are changes in the ESV that support complementarianism, and there are changes in the ESV that walk back liberal decisions in the RSV. And like by and large, I've just covered 80-90% of what is different about the ESV from the RSV.
Okay. I might be asking too specific of a question, but the verse in Genesis where it's when they're going through the curse of the woman, and they say, "Your desire shall be for your husband," and complementarianism. View wants to, I think ESV updated this.
Yeah, they did it in the permanent text edition that was not actually permanent.
Now, I heard that the proper Hebrew translation is your desire shall be for your husband's authority, which is what all the footnotes say.
In the ESV, maybe. It's not in the Hebrew. Like there's the.
So what does the Hebrew say?
What all the other translations say.
Which is your desire shall be for your husband.
Right, which may mean that. Like
I've never understood. That seemed very strange to me. I bought into the complementarian argument, the footnote that says literally means your desire shall be for your... Well, not literally
I think
means,
it might mean that too.
It's in like the study Bible. Okay, this phrase. Because I've read that many times. Even when I wasn't a complementarian, I went, what does that mean?
Right.
How is that a curse?
The problem is what the ESV claims to be. The ESV claims to be a literal translation.
No, they claim to be... what's the formal equivalence?
Right, as opposed to dynamic equivalence, which is basically saying
ESV is dynamic equivalence.
No, I think they try to eschew the categories, but they say that they lean way more toward formal than dynamic.
Okay, because the NASB was Mr. Formal Equivalency.
So here's an interesting example that I found in Amos at one point when I was teaching. In the ESV, there's a verse in Amos that says, "I gave you cleanness of teeth in all your cities." And you look at that and you're like, what is this? Like a crest ad?
Okay.
And if you read the NIV says, I gave you hunger in all your cities. And that's when you realize that like, oh, your teeth are clean because you haven't been eating.
Okay. So the NIV
equivalence translation is going to not bring in any interpretation. They're just going to give you what
they're going to say. Cleanliness of teeth.
Cleanness of teeth.
And just let the reader
leave it be.
Interpret it. Just look up a commentary and look up that this is
exactly.
A phrase from antiquity.
And in the Genesis passage that we're talking about, I think it's 3:14. Yeah. In that passage, the literal translation is your desire will be for your husband.
Okay.
Period. Just full stop.
And they just do not.
And the ESV made a decision to add a theological translation to that verse, which is why everybody was up.
And it's a footnote, right?
No, it's in the translation.
So they
itself.
Added it to the, okay. All right. That's what I was getting at.
And I think what it is your desire will be against your husband was what they changed it to. So,
okay. All right. So, which is, they claim, what the original was trying to get at.
But like prepositions are pretty simple and like maybe that's what it was trying to get at, but it used the word for and you literally change the preposition.
Well, I have read that that's what the original text was trying to say.
Right. Well, and of course.
And I mean, you just brought up that sometimes, you know, the text has a cultural phrase or an idiom or some sort of phrase that meant something back then that it's just kind of been lost in translation over time. That might be one of those things. where it actually does try, it is trying to convey the sense that the part of the curse, it is part of the curse for a woman, is that her desire will be for her husband's authority.
I think against is the way they render it now.
Same
against,
it's the same concept. Right. It's the same concept. And so, and I don't want to get, I should stop what I'm trying to say here, because we have limited time, David, and a lot to talk about.
Anyway, you can tell I don't have a lot to say positive about the ESV.
Well, can we, so you use ESV because of the culture that you're in, the milieu that you're in.
I was doing youth ministry, and I found it easier to teach out of than the NASB. Like, say what you want about the NASB. My professor at Moody said it's like chewing sawdust.
What?
So a really good example here is in the Gospel of John, Jesus says, whoever believes in me, as it is written, out of his, and in the KJV, it says out of his bowels, I think it's out of his bowels, will flow rivers of living water.
Okay.
In the ESV, it says heart. So we've like swapped out the organ in an understandable way, arguably for theological reasons, because we think about the heart as the seat of the affections.
The NASB renders
it as out of his innermost being.
Okay.
So all sense of poetry has just been lost. And NASB does this very frequently, where there's a poetic expression, and rather than try to update the poetry to make sense to the modern reader, they ditch the poetry and bring in prose like
it's a very NASB thing to do.
Like 34 pounds of prose in a bag.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly what they're trying to do.
Right. And so it's hard to teach out of in some sense, because it feels very much like you're reading a textbook.
Okay. Well, I mean, the final thing I will say about the ESV, one of the few criticisms I have of it, I don't have very many, far fewer than you.
You're welcome.
But the footnoted the translation choices, the creative ones, where the ESV people feel it necessary to add a footnote and explain in further detail what they were trying to do in the footnotes. More often than not, the ESV would footnote something and says original manuscript literally says da 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 da.
Right.
The NASB would put that in their main text. What the ESV says it said literally, but it chose not to use that literal phrase. The NASB does it.
Just does it. Yeah.
I keyed in on that early on, and that's what kind of had me hang on to the NASB for so long. So I'm like, I don't want license from the translators. I don't want that. Mm-hmm. I have the tools at my disposal to figure out what this strange phrase means from the scholars that I have access to. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to play around with creative choices by the translators. I just felt it wasn't as safe. I really didn't. Not that there are bad translators and that you can't communicate the thought or the meaning with different words. I think that's still safe. Mm-hmm. I still think it's the word of God, but I just felt uncomfortable with it.
Mm.
I don't pay attention to that much anymore, because I just haven't picked up my NASB in forever.
Right.
But anyway, so here we are, David. A small little, a further evolution happened in your life, didn't it?
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. And then what happened, David?
I mean, basically I took the TR position.
ESV, and you shot it and burnt it.
I did not do that.
Okay.
It is on the shelf behind you.
Okay.
Okay. Although I don't know which version it is, because there's like 9 versions of the ESV now. Hey, 9.
Yeah. Hey, great. It is true, actually.
Yeah. It's very difficult to keep up with how often they update.
I have an old ESV. My wife, the one I bought in college, she uses currently as her number one. Mm. I should look at that and see what kind of changes.
Yeah, lots of differences.
I haven't bought a new ESV in forever.
And they're all really oddly subtle. Well, not all of them. There's that one in Genesis 3:14, obviously.
So you went back to a translation, didn't you?
I did.
The Book of the Puritans.
The basic, the Anglicans anyway. The basic reason for this was that I came to the confessional text position. I started, when I went to Moody.
Whoa, I've never heard that phrase before. Confessional text position.
Oh, I can explain that in a minute.
All right.
But,
all right.
I went to Moody. I was taught about textual criticism. I came down on the side of basically the NA 27 or NA 28, depending on which one you're reading, like what year it is. And I started reading the ESV because of that. And then.
So you accepted the argument.
I did, basically. I mean, I didn't know that there was a counter argument. So when you take a class on textual criticism, they teach you that like there are certain rules in terms of like, some people listening to this might not even know what textual criticism is. So the basic idea is we do not have the original manuscript. Nobody has the exact sheet of paper.
You heard it here.
Sheet of papyrus that Paul wrote.
Let's just Hebrews go ahead. On. Let's just go ahead and say it. I might as well just accept it and move on.
That's how you convince someone.
Yeah. Oh, I give in.
So we don't have that, right? We don't have the original manuscripts. What we have are copies, and errors can occur in copying. And we want to make sure that we have the closest thing. I remember when I went to Moody, we had this, this exercise where they gave us, it was in English. So there was no translation work necessary, but it was this story about like a girl who went to the store and bought some bread and got in a car accident or something. No, it wasn't that traumatic, but whatever it was just this boring story. But there are little details in it, like what color shoes did she wear and like how fast did she drive and what kind of car and all that. Yeah. But it was written in all caps with no spaces, no punctuation,
that's Greek.
And they gave us 6 copies of this. Yeah. And they told us like, this is basically what textual criticism is. They all have very subtle differences.
Yeah.
And your job is to try to figure out which one is the original. I'm not even convinced there actually is an original in the exercise that they gave us, because that would kind of defeat the purpose of the of the exam, because the purpose is to show that like this is really hard and you know. So and they gave us these like 5 or so core principles of textual criticism. Mm-hmm. You always prefer the oldest, because we assume that errors will come in later on down the line as more copies are made. Mm-hmm. Like a Xerox of a Xerox of a Xerox of a Xerox. We assume that the more difficult text is the correct one. So like if there's one that says something like, and Jesus was not God, and there's one that says, and Jesus was God, you're going to kind of favor the one that says Jesus was not God. This isn't an actual verse, and this is an extreme example.
But I have not.
If you have something that makes you go, is that heresy? Like there's a good chance that that was the original, because if somebody's going to correct the Bible, like they're going to correct it to the understanding that everybody already understands. Like they're not going to carry on like baptism now saves, right? If we had translations that baptism doesn't save, we would prefer the translation baptism now saves because that's the more difficult one. I have to do more to make that make sense.
Okay.
And one would assume that a lazy translator might tweak that to like, just kind of help avoid that error or whatever. Yeah. These are the arguments. And there were a few other ones. Those are the two that stuck the most strongly in my mind as things that I'm now opposed to.
So can you at least agree that that is sound? It's a sound argument, not just all that seems to make sentimental sense.
I don't. It's sound, I think, the right set of presuppositions.
True. Yeah. That. Yeah. Obviously.
Like if we're dealing with Plato, then these are probably the right ways to come to the closest approximation of Plato. But if we're dealing with a manuscript that God has promised to preserve throughout all ages, then, for example, like I would want to argue that when you accept the idea of divine preservation, that volume of manuscript trumps to some degree earliness of manuscript.
That's not the logical flow of that doesn't make sense to me, because the fact of the matter is that the earlier manuscripts are what they are.
But they could have been thrown out. They could, like what we have is like 16 or fewer. I can't remember. I know it's no higher than 16. We have 16 manuscripts that contradict all the other manuscripts and each other. That's the Alexandrian text that we're talking about. They disagree more among themselves than any other body of manuscripts.
It's been a while for me. Textus Receptus is what family?
Byzantine.
And then the minority text is Alexandrian.
Alexandrian.
Right? Okay, it's been a while.
So we have those texts and they all disagree with each other. Yeah. And most of modern textual criticism is basically looking.
I'm not challenging you, but they all disagree with each other. Is that?
Well, not on every single word, but what I'm saying is there's more disagreement among these 16 or so Alexandrian manuscripts.
What kind of disagreement? I mean,
on huge things like where you put this or that passage in the Gospel of Mark or things like how, whether you render, things like, we have peace with God or let us have peace with God.
So if you take out volume, what accounts for the difference then? Cause one of them is earlier. And the argument I still think holds water that they're probably more close to the originals than this large volume. Yes, of course, Textus Receptus, much bigger volume than the minority. I mean, after all, it's called a minority text.
Right.
But I mean, still, so, they're earlier. You know? Right.
So,
but,
like, but if I have a copy of,
so what happened though? I mean, I'm honestly asking.
Like, if I have a copy of a transcript from our episode that's just completely wrong in 15 ways.
Yeah.
And so I throw it out.
I probably wrote it.
Right. Yeah. I throw it out. I toss it in the garbage bin, and forget to take the garbage out. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I create the correct one. And I distribute that one, and that one goes out to the masses and gets copied and copied and copied and copied and copied in all these different places.
Yeah.
And then the Holocaust, not the Holocaust, the nuclear Holocaust hits in 5 years, 10 years. And these manuscripts are dated. They're dated, you know, 4 or 5 days apart because I had to get the correct one from Amazon or whatever.
Okay.
If I do that and you go back and you discover that this manuscript sitting, you know, in my kitchen is 5 days earlier than the one that everybody else has.
Yeah.
You know, 100 years from now, you're going back and you're doing this research. You might conclude that this one is the correct one, but it's not. I threw it away.
You're speaking as the author. How about someone who doesn't know the difference? How do they know that the original one, not the original one, the earlier one is incorrect, like you're saying?
That's what I'm saying.
You're just assuming that's incorrect.
You can't assume anything.
How do we know? Then we need to have something to compare those two.
Right. Well, and this is the problem of textual criticism, right? We don't have the original to compare it to.
I don't mean original. I mean, how do we know to what degree these were changed? The minority texts, the earlier ones. How do we know to what degree these are changed? You said that they disagree with each other. So we can tell that. Yes.
Right.
But like what do we have before that? Like, do we have,
we don't have anything before that.
So then how can you say that the Textus Receptus, improves upon the minority text? Because so far you've just said volume.
Because what I'm trying to say is, first of all,
and it's a theological thing, I understand that.
On the one hand, it is entirely possible that these Alexandrian manuscripts were lost for so long because they were thrown out. It's entirely possible that they didn't make it through because they were bad. That is entirely possible.
Still a better presupposition, though.
Right. Both of them are presuppositions, right?
Yeah.
And so the question really for textual criticism for me comes down to, what should be your presuppositions?
Okay.
And so for me, when I look at like what the modern textual criticism movement, by relying on these Alexandrian texts, has done, is removed 60 plus verses from the Bible. Yeah. Like, either remove them or put them in brackets and say you shouldn't preach on this.
So how do I know that those 60 plus verses were not embellishments by a scribe wanting to describe a theology and expand upon it?
Because God promised to preserve his word. And these are the manuscripts that literally everybody has been reading from documented like 350 AD up until 18 something AD.
350 AD, huh?
We have documentation from Augustine arguing that the woman caught in adultery is legitimate and that there were people in his day trying to remove it.
Yeah. Like, that's a powerful argument. I'm not saying it isn't.
And this is the other thing, is it's not just a matter of, oh, I accept the Textus Receptus. This is what it is for me is the.
I'm just nervous about the volume. I'm just nervous about the volume argument. Now, I mean, saying that God will preserve his text. Well, I agree with that, too.
Right.
But what I'm saying is, what's the profound difference between the minority and the majority text?
Well, if you're Baptist, there's one.
What's that one?
In Acts, here's water. What prevents me from being saved? In the Alexandrian text, in the critical text, the verse that says, "If you believe with all your heart, you can be baptized." That verse is omitted.
Well, I mean, it's not like the case for Baptist theology just falls apart without that.
No, you're right. But at what point do we say, oh, you know, like, well, we don't need this, we don't need that. Like, well, at what point?
I'm a Baptist, and I don't want that in there if it's not supposed to be. I'm okay with losing that.
But it does affect how you build your case, right?
Not that much.
I mean, arguably, there are really strong cases that help us build the Trinitarian case in 1 John.
1 John, yeah.
The woman caught in adultery is an important story. Like, I guess, what passages would you say, if you were reading through the Gospel of Luke, passages would you say, like, oh, we can just ditch this?
However your argumentation, if it's not God's word, because an argument was put forth that it was added to further explain a very important theological distinctive, you don't get to do that, though. You don't get to.
I'm not saying that we should add
anything. There is no license for that. So what I'm saying is the reason why I don't think that should be in there is because I've bought into the argument that they weren't in the earlier ones.
Because there are presuppositions, though, that you are accepting.
I am. I think, and I'm admitting that.
That I think presuppose that God does not preserve his word. Because
I don't think so, because the Trinity can be proved without that passage from 1 John.
I didn't say preserve this or that doctrine. I said preserve his
word.
Well,
those are the differences. Because God's word is still existing. God's word exists in the minority text as well.
So I've heard you say you're this. Saying that God has preserved his word. It's just missing things.
The minority text?
Yes.
Missing things that were added.
No, missing things, period. Because I believe, obviously we disagree about this. Yeah. This is what we disagree about.
Sure, yeah. Well, I mean, I'm kind of teasing this out and working this out with you. And for the first time, I'm not like getting mad while I'm doing it. So I've grown, but I'm trying to throw things against the David wall.
Right.
Cause I honestly want to understand. I'm freely admitting that I've bought into the minority text,
right.
Ideas. I've freely bought into it, but they're still there and I don't know how to tear them down. And I need your help to do that. And what you're telling me is that God promised that he will preserve his word throughout all the ages for the church.
Right.
Well, for everybody, actually. But I'm not saying that that isn't true. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying, I disagree with my position on the minority text destroys that. I don't think that's true. God's word has been preserved.
But it kind of hasn't in the sense that like you couldn't get.
Because the minority, the majority text has had so much dominance.
Well,
is that what you mean?
Because, yes.
So
because
we haven't had access to the minority text for so long.
For, let's call it 1,200 years. We'll just round it.
Yeah.
For 1,200, actually 1,400. For 1,400 years, you could not really find a Bible mm-hmm. that didn't have these extra verses in it.
Okay.
Doesn't that bother you?
It doesn't. Because, I don't know if your head's going to explode. It doesn't because I believe that God has preserved his word.
But you're just contradicting yourself.
I can't. No, I don't think that God's word is not being preserved because of the majority text having so much dominance for so long. Because we do have translators that, and we have texts that I think may have been embellished every now and then. And over time, it's just been accepted as truth. I don't think God's word is destroyed when you go from that to the minority text, when you go from the KJV to the ESV.
But destroyed is different. That might be not a jot, not a tittle will pass away.
So we have to. So what have you done with the possible embellishments?
What do you mean?
If you accept the argument, then you have to say that the scribes and the people that have the people that have held the Textus Receptus and have produced Bibles from it mm-hmm. over time, you have to, where do those additions come from?
They're not additions. They've been in the text all along. The
whole time.
They were written by Paul. There were 16 weird anomalies. Like if you accept my position, Paul or whoever wrote the New Testament.
How do you know?
If you accept my position, what you have to say is, Paul, like the Bible that we have in the form of something like the KJV or the Geneva Bible or the Textus Receptus, the New Testament, let's just deal with the New Testament for now. Mm-hmm. The New Testament that we have is one and the same mm-hmm. in every way that even remotely matters. There might be a couple places where there's a funny little like accent on a letter or that doesn't change the meaning or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the Bible that we have mm-hmm. is what Paul wrote, that's what we have.
Well, that's and what that we there have are, to say. That's what I believe.
That there are 16 funky manuscripts that were written in Alexandria.
16. Is it 16 for the whole New Testament? Or
it's like it's the equivalent of 16 full copies of the New Testament ish. I think it's actually less than that. And a lot of these are just like fragments.
You're
of
talking
John
about
or whatever.
Total volume that we have
in terms of what we have is roughly 16 versions.
Well, I know that's a big disparity, but I didn't know it was that small. This is also part of the problem. I don't know all the facts.
And that is the other thing that's funny here is like if we were talking about it's 450 versus 580, then volume plays less of a thing for me.
Yeah.
And this is the other thing too is if we're talking about 1,000 years versus a couple hundred years, then age might play. But what we're talking about is not more than a couple hundred years difference between the earliest Byzantine texts.
I didn't know that they're Byzantine texts that go back that far. I guess I just didn't know that.
I mean, the majority of them are from closer to like 600-ish.
Okay.
But we do have, we do have Byzantine texts, and they all agree. Like the agreement among the Byzantine texts is remarkable in comparison to the Alexandrian.
Well, that I know. Yeah, that I know is true.
So if you accept my position, what you have to say is, gee, there was a little while there where somewhere in Alexandria, a few guys wrote some really weird manuscripts. And for some reason, from about 1850 on, there was a weird movement in academia to accept those as unique. If you accept your argument, though, mm-hmm. like what we have to say is that the Apostle Paul wrote these books, you know, mm-hmm. the apostles wrote these books. They were corrupted roughly 200 years after they were mm-hmm. written. Editions were made
too corrupted.
Additions, 60 plus verses were added to the New Testament.
But like no new doctrines have been created.
Well, you don't know that.
Okay, well, all right.
So
there's a lot you and I don't know.
I mean, arguably,
neither of us have the originals. Like,
arguably, if we were all working from the copy of 1 John that had the verse that clearly explains the Trinity, yeah. if we were all working from that when we nailed down the Nicene Creed, whether the Trinity is true or not, the Nicene Creed is suspect. We should probably redo it.
Because the Nicene Creed was...
Because the Nicene Creed was written at a time when everybody thought that verse was in the Bible. If you eliminate that verse from the equation, the doctrine of the Trinity doesn't fall. But I think the whole idea that we have this huge history behind it is a little bit shaky when you realize that one of the clearest verses on the subject longer valid.
I disagree on the shakiness of that, because every formulation of the Trinity that I've read, that at least written in modern times. Well, I mean, come on.
We stand on the shoulders of giants, but those giants had peg legs.
Okay, well, I don't know where you're taking that argument, but I'll finish my sentence.
I'm sorry.
Every modern formulation of the doctrine of the Trinity has been pretty adequate without that passage from 1 John. I mean...
You mean like complementarianism in the EFS?
Okay, I don't know why you're shoehorning that in.
I'm just saying we've been screwed up on the Trinity for a while now.
Jim got the joke. Okay, it just took me a couple seconds.
What I'm trying to say is when people appeal to the historicity of the Trinity, like the historicity of the doctrine of the Trinity, when you realize that these people were like the Athanasian Creed, the Nicene Creed, that these people were working from manuscripts that had these verses.
When was the Nicene Creed written?
450-ish.
Okay.
It might have been 380.
Some form of the Byzantine text was around then. I'm asking from complete ignorance. Were the writers of the Nicene Creed working from that verse?
Well, as far as we know, I mean, Augustine was.
Yeah. And that's a fantastic argument. Okay.
I guess I've been really unclear about this point.
I'm operating from presuppositions.
I gotcha.
And that's what and I always say that about you. Because you say things and you just kind of go way past your presuppositions, and you just go so fast none of us realize that, oh, David has some presuppositions. I guess I should try and learn a little bit more about those. I have them and you have them. That's what we should be talking
about.
That's
kind of the interesting thing about this, like flogging interesting thing for this.
And I freely admit I bought into some things, and perhaps uncritically, because there's just some facts of the matter that I'm ignorant of, and I should be a little bit more educated on them if I'm going to take such a stand on this. But I'm just having fun arguing with you and not getting upset about it. I've grown. So
yes, this is fun.
This is fun. Well, I mean, so there's like a list of things that I want to look at now. I do want to look at the strength of the Byzantine text in early times. I just want to see what's there. Mm-hmm. How does Augustine have access to it? And to what extent? What's the largesse of the Byzantine text at the time?
Right.
That would kind of strengthen the Textus Receptus argument.
And it does. More difficult the further back you dig.
Right. And that's where a lot of the minority text advocates go. They say, look, you know, let's go back even further.
280 or whatever.
Yeah. Let's just go farther back. But I don't know the dates.
Yeah. I want to flip the presuppositions on their head, though.
Isn't that what we always want to do?
And I just like my whole argument is, if God promised to preserve his word, then maybe like these issues need to be dealt with one by one. We need to deal with the woman caught in adultery on its own. Like the validity of the woman caught in adultery because there are different texts to consider. There are different quotes from church fathers from different times to consider. That one needs to be handled on its own. That the validity of that does not necessarily affect in any way the validity of the True. Longer ending of Mark.
But like, still, the day I found out that that was a disputed text, I was crushed.
Well, and like the charismatic
I was
movement.
So crushed. Like the day I discovered.
Are you talking about the woman caught in adultery or the.
Caught in adultery.
Yeah.
That was hard for me to accept. And I mean, of course, the Lord's Prayer.
Yep.
That was hard.
For thine is the kingdom.
It still bothers me.
Mm-hmm. That's a huge one. Can we talk about that for a second? Because so much of Christian doctrine in terms of how we are to pray has been formulated for centuries around that as the ending to the prayer.
Yeah.
And now
I'm a product of that.
Now we have 150 years of people saying, nah, it shouldn't be there. Yeah.
That's an example. If I were to ever turn, mm-hmm. it might be through that stuff like that.
But and that's why I'm saying though, it's not the validity of that does not affect the validity of the woman caught. Like we need to handle them each on their own.
Okay.
But when we talk about the presuppositions, if you're dealing with Plato, it makes sense to say, of course, corruption is going to creep in over time. If you're dealing with the Bible, it might make sense to say, of course, what God has given to his church is probably the correct thing. Of course, what the church has had is probably the correct thing because he promised to give us the correct
thing. The truths
thing.
Are correct or the manuscripts are correct. You know what I mean?
I mean, the truths are said by the words, right?
True. But, you know,
we debate over doctrine far more than we debate over individual verse, like how individual verses should be rendered.
I wish we could do the latter more. Okay. Well, I mean, I wanted to record a short show today.
I'm sorry.
No, this is great. I want to talk about this some more, but we should probably wrap it up here.
Probably should.
Okay. This is obviously something that I have neglected, study of this. And I am just working off of a small collection of arguments and presuppositions that are very simplistic.
And that's what I was doing.
I have some suspicions about the Textus Receptus advocacy.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking as a person who fully embraced it, endorsed it militantly so. And then I shot a bullet at it, which is strange.
Well, not the Bible, but
right. That's not what I meant. I was challenged today and I do want to look into it. Because I don't want to be relying on bad presuppositions. I always point out bad presuppositions in others. Why should I not be doing the same for myself? So that's what I'm going to end on. That's it.
We got to go.
So we'll see you all next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Won't someone save me from this podcast? Is it over or just dragging along? Will these two guys talk forever? Or will they quit if I sing them this song? Podcast. The torture started off so tongue in cheek. Now it seems it's almost over. So I'll just have to wait another.
I grew up on NAIB. want to grow up on it, but at 15, I switched to ESV because I was angry with the licensing. Oh, this is so you. Talk a little about licensing. I don't want to talk too much about that. Now I use the KJV and the Geneva Bible and the manuscripts on which they're based. Uh-huh. Textual issues for me come down to this. That's a bold claim. I'm not against textual criticisms. I'm not against textual criticism. You can read Calvin. Correct. Heck. There are quotes from Augustine arguing that the woman is genuine. There are people in his day who had impious motives for removing. Unfortunately, vicious. Every modern translation, which is something less for Cain, is best better. Where decisions and also you just find what it's kind of hard to read. I still don't know where I stand on the MEV, the MEV. It's basically all I have. Whenever I think about this, I'm reminded of Amos and I pray for reformation. Really curious how you approach the textual criticism issue. And now I'm done.
Great.
Great, Jim. Thank you for doing that.